confusing. In any case, we're going to hear their music right now, and that should take us to the end of the program. This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City, and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, online at WFMU.org. Gospel from the Brotherhood of the Cross and the Star from Nigeria.
Woe to the man that refused to hear the concept of this prophecy, revelation time, and a message for the youth of this generation. So watch out. See?
Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
He has come back again.
Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
Badam, ting, 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 ting.
Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
They gonna hear this. He has come back again. Now come back again. As the King of Kings, come back again. He has come back again. As the Lord of Lords, come back again. He has come back again. As King Olumbabu,
Jesus. Jesus Christ,
original,
the Son of God,
real,
has come back again.
He has come back again.
Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
Badam, ting, 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 ting.
Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
They couldn't hear this. He has come back again and I'll come back again. As the King of Kings, come back again, he has come back again. As the Lord of Lords, come back again, he has come back again. As King Olumbabu,
Jesus Christ,
right now.
Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
He has come back again.
Oh, go to the world, go tell them now that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again. Now, go to the world, go tell them now that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again. Now,
Jesus Christ,
original Jesus,
the Son of God, has come back again.
He has come back again.
Jesus. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
Badam, ting, 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 ting.
Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
Badam, 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 he has come back again and I'll come back again. As the King of Kings, come back again, he has come back again. As the Lord of Lords, come back again, he has come back again.
Jesus,
Madam, Madam,
Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
Badam, ting, ting, ting.
Jesus, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
He has come back again.
Go to that one, go to them now that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again. Now, go to that one, go to them now that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again. Now,
Jesus. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
Badam, ting, 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 ting.
Jesus, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
He has come back again.
Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
Badam, 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 he has come back again. And I'll come back again. As the King of Kings, come back again, he has come back again. As the Lord of Lords, come back again, he has come back again. As King Olumbabu,
Jesus. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has come back again.
Badam, ting, 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 ting.
Jesus,
right on.
Jesus Christ, original
Jesus.
Over me,
over me, the blessed.
The pronouncement of Olumba Olumba is showered upon us. Can you sing it?
Over me.
I say,
over me. The blessings of His holiness is over me.
Over my businesses. Over my family. The pronouncement of Olumba Olumba is showered upon us. Can you sing it?
Over me.
Hallelujah.
Over me. The blessings of His holiness is over me.
Look at yourself and compare yourself now. What you were in one decade ago. It's a pronouncement of Olumba Olumba is showered upon us. Can you sing it?
Over me.
Hallelujah.
Over me. The blessings of His holiness is over me.
Many years ago, you were looking for food to eat. Many years ago, you were looking for food to eat. Recap yourself, you have no place to live. May Abba Father come change your story now.
Over me.
Hallelujah.
Over me.
Your story.
The blessings of His holiness.
You're listening to Morricone Island and WFMU. I'm your host, Devin Elevens, here every Tuesday from 8 to 9 p.m. playing the soundtrack hits, and this week is no exception. We have joining us extra special guest, legendary musician, composer, conductor, actor, poet, writer, David Amram, still busy as ever at the age of 91, got his start many, many years ago as Leonard Bernstein's chosen first composer in residence for the New York Philharmonic, also a composer for jazz, funk, classical symphonies, concertos, Arthur Miller plays, Broadway plays, goes on and on. Even the original Joe Papp Shakespeare in the Park productions back in the day. And we, of course, we're going to do our best to cover a lot of that, but most topically for his incredible work in the 60s, primarily for Elia Kazan's Splendor in the Grass and the arrangement back in 1969. And then, of course, John Frankenheimer's Manchurian Candidate and Young Savages, two great New York films, have New York moments in them. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for the glowing introduction, and to all your listeners, all blessings to you. Listen to the radio, and then when you turn it off, be creative yourselves.
Yes. I mean, just right off the bat, when I was in touch with you originally back in May, you were in the middle of you were in Kansas, and then you were in New England, and you were kind of back in New York, and you're busy as ever. And then right now, getting back in touch with you, your September just ramps right back up. You have this festival, the New York Chamber Music Festival coming up, and then you're going to be doing Farm Aid for the 31st time. And then you're going out to the Kurt Vonnegut Centennial in Indianapolis. It's like, it's nonstop. You're living by your own words, for sure.
Well, I'm fortunate also, there's something called the Village Trip. This is their fifth year, the year before last, they got COVID-ed out. And I'm what they call the artist emeritus, because I was the artist in residence the first year. And then if you're old enough, you become an emeritus.
Yeah.
If you're not buried. But my main thing is that I'm trying to be sort of a cheerleader to all the young painters, poets, musicians, actors, and parents who want to bring their kids to something that isn't total putrescence, of which there is an enormous amount already, so we don't have to deal with that. But there's all these wonderful actors and poets and musicians and writers and dancers and sculptors and bartenders and waitresses who all have a wonderful philosophy and a wonderful energy. That's kind of what has kept me going all my life, by hanging out with those who know more than me, who are aware. And the festival this year, they're doing everything through the village, where I'm commissioned to write a new piece setting Kerouac's, part of Kerouac's wonderful section from the book The Lonesome Traveler, a section called Ah, Take Me Back to the Village. And I said, wow, that's the one to use. And I just rehearsed with two classical guitar players. They don't use capos and they don't use amps, and a wonderful classical singer. And it also has jazz and all the different Latin music, all the wonderful things that are part of New York City in the piece written down on paper. And I just went to the rehearsal yesterday, a group called Vox and with an apostrophe plus. And then I'm doing a program called Classical Jack the next night. And then I'm doing a wonderful thing at Joe's Pub with the great Bobby Sanabria, showing jazz and Afro-Cuban music of the 50s and how important that is today and how that relates to Kerouac and all of us. And then I'm also doing a program honoring Phil Oakes, doing a whole bunch of stuff. And then I zoom off to Farm Aid, and then I go to Indianapolis. But the only reason I mention that is, if younger folks are listening, you can do something too. And if your grandparents are listening, hang out with your grandchildren, which I do with my grandson, and also try to enjoy intergenerational activity, not to be a great liberal, but just to be a human being, because we could all learn from each other. And I think the old people, and like myself, have something to offer, because if nothing else, we can tell people what not to do or how not to do it if we screwed up 120 times till we found out a better way of doing it. So that's more the Solomon-esque wisdom of old age, of having messed up yourself, figuring out how you could avoid doing that. And secondly, a lot of the blessings that were bestowed upon us by our elders, we can try and pass that stuff on too. So it makes life more beautiful than ever and keeps you going. And someone said, well, man, how do you get that energy? You're going to be 92 this November. And I said, very simply, desperation is very stimulating.
Words to live by, yes. I have found that you can also learn from, even if you're someone's coming to you to teach them something, you learn from watching somebody just pick something up for the first time. You can learn from the mistakes and the reasons why they choose to do one thing over another. And, you know, it's always kind of a learning process. It's like a two-way street, like you said.
Absolutely. It's what they call on-the-job training. And life is on-the-job training if you keep your mind and your heart open and you can accept suggestions. I wouldn't say vicious criticism, but you can accept constructive suggestions from those who know more than you. And there's a whole bunch of people out there every day you can meet who not only can teach you a lesson, but you can learn something about anything because they know more about it than you do. Above and beyond that, there's a thing called civilization, and a lot of people in the most unlikely places, according to our peer culture, are extremely civilized. And I mention that because I know you're working on, you do a show about films, and I never dreamed I would be writing music for films. I enjoy doing it, and I explained when finally someone put out a 5-CD set of all the film music I'd done. I said, I'm not a film composer. I'm a composer who occasionally writes for films. And when I do, I try to do this with as much loving care as when I write a concerto, a symphony, an opera, or when I'm playing with Willie Nelson, just going on my dumbek and playing a little penny whistle solo. I try it with him to fit in to his world. And you learn how to be a accompanist and a sideman by being a leader, so to speak. And when I did The Manchurian Candidate, which was a pretty far-out movie, especially in 1962, John Frankenheimer said to me the golden words. He said, David, do what you feel. My only advice is, number one, it's not a Chinese war movie. Number two, the film will tell you what to do. And when I worked for Shakespeare in the Park, I watched those great actors. Oh, man, were they good. And Shakespeare's great words. You couldn't help but write some good music because they were telling you what it was and what to do. And that's true with just about anything. You have to almost have the sense of doing it on one line where you're sitting there in an empty room saying, man, what am I going to do now? How do I do that? And when I played one chord 37 times, the wonderful person I was with at the time said, man, you were playing that same chord for an hour. I said, well, I want to make sure I get it right. And sometimes to get it right, you have to turn off all your so-called education, your toolbox of what you learn. You forget about that stuff, and you just do it by feeling of which of those 37 choices feels like it's saying something. And that's self-editing. And Jack Kerouac, of all people, did that in his head. I knew him and hung out with him and played with him. When, by the time he wrote it down on paper, he'd already figured most of it out. And Mozart did that when he wrote the symphonies. He wasn't a speed calligrapher. He wrote what he already had figured out and put together when he was doing it. And most of the writers, like Cervantes, I mean, we read Don Quixote, who could imagine hanging out with a washed-up nobleman jousting with windmills and his friend Sancho Panza, who ate cloves of garlic, was Dr. Funkenstein of the duo, who could imagine in today's world anybody would read that book? But man, it's saying something, and it's telling a great story. And when people see the Lascaux cave paintings 25,000 years ago, pay all that money to go over to southern France and then pay to go into the caves, no one's asked for a refund that we know of, because that stuff is still hip. And as John Keats, the greatest jazz poet of the 19th century, said, a thing of beauty is a joy forever. And I think that's true. We do have standards, and you could even use those standards if you decide to write music for a film. And there are film composers who have done that. Nino Rota, my goodness, is that good music. And the music for The Godfather, incredible. And John Carigliano's music that he did for the violin, amazingly good music. And the song, the violin music that John Williams wrote for Schindler's List, that's my favorite thing that he ever wrote that I've heard, just a great piece of music without the film. I only mention because whatever you're doing, or when I was brought up on a farm, we were taught to try to make a straight line as much as possible when you're putting in the corn and soybeans, especially corn because you wanted to cultivate around it. And when you're milking the cow, not to put water in the pail to make it weigh enough and save time, but to do a good job. And the concept of doing a good job and hard work is completely out of the picture. But we have to remember that's their prerogative in their position to act that way. But that's on them. It ain't on you. So we all have to do better than is expected, do really great work, and hope for the best, because right. There's no guarantee. But it makes you feel better. And then you're doing what we're all put here to do, and you have a better life because you're not ashamed and disgusted, cynical, mad, and angry at everybody because some other rip-off artist has ripped off more than you have done. That's an overcrowded field and a non-growth industry. So all of us have to get it together, listen to WFMU, try to listen to your show, and think for themselves, how can we do better, and what can we do for ourselves and our family and our friends or whatever kind of work we do, and put some effort into that just for our own satisfaction, the mental, spiritual survival to do a good job.
When you were handed Manchurian Candidate, which you just mentioned, from John Frankenheimer, was it kind of a blank canvas? Was it finalized as far as the cut and everything, and then you were kind of left at your own devices, or?
It was kind of like a gigantic crossword puzzle with half of the pieces lying around in different places. And I'd read the script, which was amazing, and the book, which was amazing. I was playing at a place called the Montecito Hotel, where the New York actors would go mostly, so that they could talk about playing Chekhov and Shakespeare in the Park when they were doing Wagon Train, and they'd sit around the swimming pool reading the New York Times, talking about Strindberg and Paddy Chayefsky's work and Arthur Miller's work, and never mentioning that they were working on show they were doing so they could afford to go back to New York City and be a great artiste for a year, you know, looking for a gig or playing in some fantastic masterpiece. And hardly being able to pay the rent. So it was a wonderful place because all the people there were so devoted to acting and the theater. And they were doing a good job in the films, but they weren't trying to be movie stars. They were just there glad to get a gig and get paid, do better than was expected and go home. So I was sitting in my little room and they kept sending me things of different parts of the film. Suddenly I would say, oh, and then it would go blank and they'd have a black thing saying this will be done. And everything was out of sequence. It was amazing. Fortunately, I had read the script. So the one thing was that famous scene when it looks like they're having a Savannah tea party with the women all dressed up with their gloves and their beautiful outfits. And suddenly they dissolve into these North Korean and Chinese guards and generals and prison guards and a bunch of American soldiers stoned out on psychotropic drugs being brainwashed. And they had that famous scene where they panned for about 2 minutes. And I looked at it and I said, oh my God, man, what? This is an outtake. Why did they send that to me? Then the phone rings and John Frankenheimer said, did you just get that scene? I said, yes. He said, how did it make you feel? And I said, well, frankly, man, you know, I thought I was going nuts. I said, it really shook me up. I said, boy, that whoever did that's like, what's crazy? is that going to be in the movie? He said, of course. He said, that's the idea. We want to show the audience what it's like to have psychotropic drugs and be in that world and be brainwashed to the extent that you would kill your best friend when you're told to and act as if nothing was happening. I said, wow. And then he said, and you can help that scene by figuring out some kind of music that will make it even more that way. So I had the idea, which I never did, of using a harpsichord and three piccolos playing what sounded like Arnold Schoenberg's latest, greatest outtakes. And I tried to take the most hideous, wrong notes I could possibly assemble, and playing jazz and folk music and loving Bach and Vivaldi and Bartok and Stravinsky and so many other people. I was always looking for what they called in jazz then the choice notes, the beautiful notes, the things that felt harmonious, regardless of what it was that meant something. I said, forget about that. This is a scene of deranged, stoned out, murderous. So I took everything as hideous as I could, and I put sort of a Viennese waltz on that I wrote on top of that, being accompanied by these dreadful notes. Almost every reviewer says that that was marvelous music by the avant-garde composer. I was so derrière-garde. I was back in the Elizabethan times writing music for Shakespeare in the Park. So knowing what I thought were right, beautiful notes, I was able to make it truly hideous, and it worked for that scene. The hard part was writing the principal theme, which was difficult because I didn't want to make it sound like 427 other pieces that had already been written, and using counterpoint and trying to make it into a real piece of music. That was tough. I spent days working on that. It's interesting because the thing that I was able to do so easily was figuring I'm going to do everything I can and make it as wrong as possible. And I don't say that to disparage other composers or other films, but there is a thing called melody, harmony, and counterpoint. And when you listen to The Birth of the Cool and you hear those magnificent voicings and the jazz harmonies, and you listen to the Bach Brandenburg concertos, you listen to any music in the world, or you listen to the great players who followed Charlie Parker and Bird and Dizzy, who are my heroes, and every single person who played with them just always had a magnificent choice of notes. There, when you heard Ornette Coleman and the work of John Coltrane, they were moving that in a different direction. But when you really listen carefully, you feel that sense of balance and organization and expressiveness and telling a story. You can't prove that. And if you sit down and have a discussion in some panel, someone will say, "What is beauty?" And then you're sunk, because that's the great unknown. That's stuff like looking out and seeing the beautiful trees and the sky and nature. The Native American folks, mostly, regardless of thousands of different nations, which we call tribes, which they call nations or cultures, all have in common that the great creator, whoever he, she, they be, whatever that thing we don't understand is, all of those things are a gift. We're gifted with that. When those trees blossom, when that rain falls, or when you see these extraordinary things in the sky and life itself and birth, all those things, man, there's no way to explain that. That's the great unknown. And music is the same way. Essentially, you're dealing with something that's bigger than all of us that we don't understand. But if it's saying something, it does say something, and people have their hearts touched by that. And then you can bring the brain in to function in a different way, not just to analyze it so you can subdivide it and franchise it, but just to appreciate it and say, wow, how about that? When you hear Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, you can't explain.
Yeah.
But man, is that something. And there are standards in art, in music. When you hear Charlie Parker or Monk play, as I was blessed to do when I was a young person, and knowing them, or I worked with Jack Kerouac and he was just rapping away, there was a beauty side. They were in touch with a certain element and that came through them, and they gifted us with what they received as a gift and never acted as if they were superior geniuses and we were just a bunch of lowlifes. There wasn't an egomaniac type trip. There's enough of that stuff in the culture. We don't need any more of that. And with all due respect to people who do act that way, that's because they never were around anybody who told them, you gotta cool that stuff out and get into what it's really about. Sonny Stitt, the magnificent alto player, he could play in all 12 keys. He had people sit in with him like myself who were stumbling and fumbling. And he was nice. If he saw you were trying hard, you could say please and thank you and be respectful. But I remember some guy came up and was telling him how great he was, they were, and everything. He listened very patiently. He said, man, you must be a bad cat. Let's play Cherokee at this tempo. Uh-oh. And he said, and we'll play it in B major. Because he could do that on the sax. He could play it all 12 keys. He was like terrifying, you know, technician, in addition to being so creative. So naturally, the person who, I can't remember who it was, but Mr. Egomaniac was demolished. So Sonny said to him very graciously, well, look, the next time you come to sit in with us and you're invited, leave your attitude at home. So those are just little lessons I learned, because I would know better than the worst offender. I've been brought up in this culture too. You know, if the highest level was to get out there, be a swine, rip everybody off, get to the top, and then you could dump on everybody, terrorize them, and kick them down when they're groveling to prove you're a real he-man and a successful person. However, I was fortunate enough to find that there was a different way of approaching all that stuff, and that there were no shortcuts. And the other answer was not the other side of the coin, which is being a winologist and a blameologist and saying everything sucks, but rather just to work hard and be a lifetime student, hang out with those who know more than you, and share what little blessings come your way with others, and you have a much more fun life. You're not determined by what you have to do to pay your rent. And in our society, what you deserve and what you get have nothing to do with one another. But no one forced you to want to be creative or be a good athlete or be a good astronaut or a good musician or a good actor, poet, whatever. If you choose that or you feel that you were chosen for that, well, then you just go out and spend your life trying to do it and hope for the best.
Thank you.
You've notoriously have kind of walked many different fields, you know, like from the classical world seamlessly into the jazz world, into the folk world, you know, the world music from different countries and different cultures. And you've been able to do that. Is that more because you've just been open to like whatever that next opportunity is rather than creating these make-believe boundaries that people do? Like, I can't do that. I'm a classical guy. Or I can't do that. I don't know the first thing about singing or playing this odd instrument.
Well, I didn't know the first thing about anything. And I realized that at an early age. I was brought up on a farm. I was 9 years old. And my father said, well, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I had my 7 acres. I was able to grow my own cornfield and then make half of it into a soybean field and plow those under to get more nitrogen, all that good stuff, you know. I said, well, Daddy, I want to be a farmer like you. He said, no, he said, I have to do other work in order to support my farming habit. He said, 160 acres, this is 1939, is already not enough. My brother and I, that was my Uncle David, worked for 4 years nonstop and made about $100 after we were done. They said, it's hard work. I love it, but you can't make a living doing that. He said, what else do you want to do? I said, well, I'd like to be a classical composer and a jazz musician. And he said, that's worse. I was in the position that you mentioned of what do I do? You know, being thrown off the ship. And it goes off without you. What is there a log I can hang on to? What do I do? So the sink or swim survivalist thing is a good thing. So when I would go someplace in my travels and I would hear some fantastic music that just got to me and touched my heart, I'd say, man, I'd like to know more about that. So I've stumbled and fumbled my way into all the things that I'm presumably supposed to. So now that after all these years, not that that's become more fashionable, pardon the expression, suddenly I've received critical praise as being a pioneer of world music. I said, well, when I worked for Shakespeare in the Park, the Shakespeare's plays, every one, Macbeth was a Scottish nobleman, and he wasn't from England as Shakespeare was. Hamlet was from Denmark. Othello was a Moor. Julius Caesar was from antiquity. I said all the plays he wrote about were because that London was a seaport town, and all those stories and myths. When people in New Orleans, like Dr. John, talked about his left hand being the rumba, that's what he told me in 1978 when we were at the Philly Festival. He learned that stuff from all the Cuban guys who would come over on the ships 90 miles away, and he decided he would take some of that and use that in his left hand for what he was playing. And Dizzy, when I met him in 1951, spent the whole night telling me about Pan-African music, of all the different places people from Africa, when they took their journeys, would go to different places, what they would leave and what they would take from what they had acquired to the next place. And so much of music reflects that kind of nomadic existence and heritage, or heritages in the plural. So there's so many different kinds of beautiful things. And the principal thing when you're learning new music is the rhythm, to find out where the one is. When Dizzy Gillespie, Stan Getz, Earl Hines, and I was lucky enough to be invited at the last minute, went to, as the first North Americans to ever go to Cuba since the revolution. At the very end, we were playing with Arturo Sandoval, Paquita de Rivera, Los Papinas, and all the other people who were living there still. And they weren't, before Paquito and Arturo were able to come here and, you know, come on this side. There was no sides. We were just there playing music together. Suddenly, they were having what they call wataka, which is like a big expression for let's all jam, or descarga, they would say in Puerto Rico. But they were having this big jam, sort of wataka type, everybody just playing at the end. Man, those guys were playing, and we didn't have any idea where the one was, because we wanted to come in, but we had, everything was great, and they knew what they were doing. Dizzy finally said, "Mis amigos, dando es uno, por favor, baby. Where is the one, my friend?" So, Paquita de Rivera went, which is the rumba clave, which is one, two, one, two. And right away, we knew where he was clapping the clave. Then when Alana Burke came to Lincoln Center, and we were invited, those of us who'd been there were invited to play with the Cubans when they visited here. We watched some of these old guys and gals who'd been doing that music all their life. And at one point, she turned around and clapped the clave because they got lost. I said, "Well, thank heavens, that music is so complicated." And then when I played with Los Muñequitos de Matanzas, when I was after 40 years, I got a call back from the jazz festival down there, and it was such a thrill to see the people still alive. And when I went to Matanzas and played with Los Muñequitos de Matanzas, they were doing some stuff. And I said, "Well, I knew the four components of the Wawanko. Boy, they were doing something else." Because those four things, which is one and two, and the one, oomba, oomba, oom, boom, I knew just where that came in, and the gotta, 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 gotta. I knew that one. Chika taka de chaka de chak 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 de taka de kaka de chak chak chak. Those are the four things all fit together, because they've been doing that for a few thousand years from African music that came over here a long time ago. But they weren't doing any of that, because that was built in. They were doing some other stuff on top of that, because they all knew, so they knew where they were. But man, I was lost again. And then finally, they said, "Toca, Davy, toca la flauta." You know, play, Davy, play the flute. So I went, and a kind of spirit told me what to do. I just turned off all the brain power, because I figured, well, whatever it is, I just go with it. But it's always good to be thrown into that cold shower and have the temperature where you're suddenly it's not cold anymore. You're welcomed as someone that doesn't know anything to be part of it. And they were so gracious and so terrific. And then, big international stars that they are, they all went home on their bicycles.
Right.
Whole different scene than our fake desire to be 18th century English or European noble people and be kings and queens and have everybody groveling and slobbering all over us and assuming that's the way you have to behave or that's who you have to become. You know, they were just as much in tune with the little kids when they were playing out on the street for 2 hours before their concert. And most of the great musicians that I met in all genres have that, because they realize that they're part of something that's bigger than us, and they're, wouldn't say servants, they're fans and appreciators of music and art and those who create that and the cultures that created that. So once you see that, then you have a limitless life of learning and a little bit that people nice enough to show you, you pass that on to other people. And the ones who are nice enough to show it to you generally do that because they figure, well, that guy or that gal is enthusiastic. That's how they learned it themselves, by saying, please, can you show me that? Where's the one? Where's the beginning scale? Please, thank you, please, please, thank you. Those two magic words mean a whole lot in any place you go. Being Mr. or Ms. Big, casting the pearl before the swine, or going slumming is not appreciated by anybody.
Right. You're just kind of amazing double solo album from the early 70s, No More Walls.
Sort of
ties into that. And I don't know if I've heard anything like that, that just nowadays maybe it's not that uncommon for a musical group or an artist to kind of jump genres on recording. And this, but this record, it's really takes you around the world, you know.
Well, my hope is that I was showing that it's not fusion, God help us.
Yeah.
Fusion is when they were playing, they stopped playing plain songs, bong, bong, bling, 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 and everything was in parallel fifths. Just suddenly, like when you play chopsticks, your fingers are going in two different directions. So that's not fusion, because fusion is every kind of music, including chopsticks up to the latest piece and anything, is different things happening at the same time, each one of which enhances the other part that's happening. And that's all the music made in the world comes from that. And it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it tells some kind of story and paints some kind of picture, even if it's a different story and a different picture for every listener. And it's saying something. Now, you can't prove that intellectually, because then you're stuck with, what is beauty? And then you get four angry authorities who bring out their bottle of formaldehyde and try to give you a drop of non-wisdom in terms of what someone else wrote that never learned to sing and dance. But basically, it's just some simple stuff that we don't understand, but it's there, whatever it is. And I think the extraordinary thing is that music has not only survived, but now with YouTube, a whole new generation, now for the first time in history, has a choice and an option of wading through the interminable mounds of sleaze, which has always been dumped upon us. And they can see and hear and re-see and re-hear by playing it over again some of the baddest cats and kitties that ever existed in the world doing their music, from Bulgaria and from Ireland and from all over, and Asia and Africa and the USA, all over the world. When I played Native American music with Floyd Redcore Westerman, and I told him about the porcupine singers, he said, man, we love them. I would tell people that, say, well, are they porcupines? I said, no, that's the name of the group. You can go on YouTube and hear them. You can hear Arnett Cobb, playing Deep Purple, and get a whole jazz lesson on how to play a ballad. You can hear some of the most extraordinary composers, electronic music, cooking, sports, anything, and see how to do it and look at it over and over and over again, and then turn off the TV and go out and do something, because you realize there's some terrific people out there already, and it's not something that's no longer relevant. Those who say it's relevant and would call something crossover or crossover and fusion, that's the other thing, saying is a crossover. Well, if you're in the land of beauty, which we are, if you pay attention to look outside or even feel anything other than your own problems, and you cross a bridge, like when you're in Memphis and you're going to Mississippi and you cross that bridge, you're not going to a different planet. You're seeing where the old Beale Street, those things that still come through the sidewalk from 80 years ago, that came from right across that river in the Delta. But you're still in the land of beauty. You're only crossing over a bridge to another part of that land of beauty. So in music, there's nothing to cross over to because you're already there.
Right.
That's the same thing with film. I mean, that's one of the things I loved about working for films was that you could see the actors over and over and over again, and then they would change one little scene 4 minutes away or 4 minutes before, and that would change the whole picture. So it was really something. And how they, the filmmakers, were able to shoot something completely out of sequence and still have it make sense. And I enjoyed that in terms of composing, not just for films, but when you're composing, period, of structure and timing and subtleties and returning ideas. That filmmaking is an art too, and scoring for films is an art. And the fact that it may be controlled by people who are not interested in that and think in staggering, colossal, mega, mega terms is fine, but the number of filmmakers, including people who could take the iPhone and make their own film, the whole door is opened up now for a lot of terrific stuff. And it doesn't only have to be what they would call avant-garde or whatever is considered to be trendy, but it can be anything, including something very beautiful and simple. Doesn't matter what it is, it's how you do it. And the younger filmmakers now can find all these terrific musicians who play so beautifully and are working in a dry cleaning store and would love to have some example of what they've studied. And they can compose a film score just watching the film and following what John Frankenheimer told me, the film will tell you what to do.
Right, where you started. What was that bridge that got you from more of a performer and a composer and arranger to the film world? Was it, I assume, is those two shorts you did in the late 50s, Pull My Daisy and Echo of an Era?
It was a film about the Third Avenue L, and that was just another fluke because they couldn't find someone to do it for practically nothing. And I got Cecil Taylor. That was the first score he ever did. First time he'd ever been in a recording studio in 1956. George Barrow, who played my jazz group. And I got some wonderful classical players as well. And we had music that sounded almost like Renaissance music or classical music. And then music that kind of felt like New York in the 30s and 40s. And it was really fun to work on it. And it was only because Terry Southern had heard this one little tune that I wrote called Les Oiseaux de Montparnasse, the birds of Montparnasse, where we would sit around and hear all the birds chirping. I wrote a little piece, little jazz piece, and he liked it so much, he sent it to Al Lavakian, who was the film editor. And a friend of Al said, look, I got to get a score, but I don't have any money. And so anyway, they fumbled and stumbled and got into doing it. And it really came out nicely. Then that was the same month I met Woody Guthrie on the Lower East Side where I lived, and then 50 years later wrote a symphony commissioned by his children who weren't even born then, I guess, and also met Joe Papp, who was hoped he could have Shakespeare in the Park someday, but that hadn't happened. He was doing these programs on the Lower East Side. And all these people bumped into them, and in Joe Papp's case, the person he wanted to do the music, Betty Lou Fitch, a wonderful pianist and a great lady, didn't write music. She just did it by ear, which is fine. You know, she was terrific. She played for Mary Anthony and make up stuff for an hour. She was amazing. But she said, David, I can't, they want fanfares and little marches. And I said, I don't know how to do that stuff. You went to music school. Can you get some guys together to do that? I said, sure. So I just stumbled and fumbled into that. I had no plan. But I just felt that'd be a great thing to do. With Woody, I just enjoyed meeting him so much. I said, man, I got to pay more attention to this music. And the same thing happened with just about everything that I've done. When I worked for Hal Freeman for this little teeny film that he did, I never dreamed that I'd be doing music for Hollywood movies someday. And the reason I got to do those was because John Frankenheimer was looking for someone to do music for Turn of the Screw, a television program by Henry James. And being in 19th century, he wanted music that sounded like it was from the 19th century, not from Al Hackavision's drawer of five music cues with diminished seventh chords that were written by, or, you know, they actually wanted some real music. And I just was lucky enough to get to work, and he liked it and kept asking me to do different things. And against the wishes of the producers, hired me to do the music for the Young Savages. And of course, going to Manhattan School and playing with Latin groups, I knew that neighborhood where it took place. and I was real proud of what I was able to do. And for Splendor in the Grass, Ilya Kazan went out of his way after I did JB, and I was like the 25th choice, liked my stuff so much that he convinced Warner Brothers to let an unknown person. I remember I met Jack Warner, and he said, "Well, you never did nothing." He said, and then he turned to Kazan, he said, "That Leonard Bernstein, he never did nothing either to, he was nobody till he did work, did that one to Waterfront with you." So then he turned to me and he said, "And who's today, who's greater than Leonard Bernstein?" And being a smart ass of 29, I said, "Beethoven." And I thought he was going to punch me out. But then his handlers, who were wearing these polyester suits, all started laughing as he laughed at his own joke, which he did quite often, and shrugging their shoulders with laughter. Just, he had that laughter, where he would synchronize his shoulder movements of laughing, and they all imitated him. So I was fortunate not to get punched out. And it was fun doing that. But then seeing the people who were in charge made me feel that perhaps I'd be better off pursuing the impossible course of trying to be what I told my father at 9 I wanted to be. And at 92, which I'm going to be pretty soon, I'm still trying to be that. And I'm glad that I followed those career death wishes to the max and encourage everyone to do the same thing. If you feel you were put here to do something, do it. And whatever you do to pay your rent, do that too. And not to get discouraged and not to expect anything except the satisfaction that you get from trying to do a good job and the wonderful people that you meet and continue to meet on that journey if you stay that way. Thank you.
You just heard the main theme from Splendor in the Grass from 1961, film produced and directed by Elia Kazan, starring Natalie Wood and Warren Beatty in his film debut. And then Echo of an Era, David's first film score for a short from 1959, directed by Henry Freeman, on the history of the New York City subway system. And what he refers to as Cecil Taylor's first time ever in a recording studio. And David is fortunately joining us again next week to continue our discussion of his 80-plus year career. So tune in to more Coney Island, same place, same time. WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, broadcasting at 91.9 FM in New York City and Rockland County, and online at WFMU.org.
Well, I'm just out of school, like I'm real, real cool. Gotta dance like a fool, got some messages and I gotta be a wild. I'm a wild,
wild
one.
Child.
Oh yeah, I'm a wild one.
Wild child.
Gonna break loose, gonna keep a moving wild. Gonna keep a swinging, baby, I'm a real wild child. Keep a moving wild, gonna keep a swinging, baby, I'm a real wild child. Swinging baby, I'm a real wild child. Swinging, baby, I'm a real wild child. Wanna know my name? I'm a wild child.
It out, but you can put it back. You took it out, but you can put it back again. You took a swig and then you take a crack. You're running quick, but you're running off the track. One piece to break the fall, one wave to take us all to the shore. Can't say it's what you're barking for. It's forever at the push of a button. Thank you. it up, but you can't put it back. You took it out, but you can't put it back. You feel it stinging and you wanna scratch. You found the box and you're looking for the match. One piece to break the fall. One way to take us all to the shore. Can't say it's what you're barking for. It's forever at the push of a button. A hidden rod. Took a taste and then you spit it back up. You threw the rock just to watch it splash. Sick as a dog and you're digging